everybody. Do we have anybody here today that's new to our center? Welcome. What is your name?
Charlene.
Nice to have you, Charlene. Please stay around afterwards for some little goodies. Today we have Doug's...
Sorry.
No, that was me.
You did. It's like you're right.
I'll sit. Right, no tears. I'll sit in Doug's lap.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Doug Sparks is from Boulder, and he is a student of Ken Wapnick's, and we are so fortunate to have him at least every 3 months here for our gathering. And then afterwards at 1 o'clock, there is a workshop from 1 to 4, and it's $25, and we'd love to have you join us. The gathering is going to be Getting Past Course Mythology, and the workshop is going to be a talk about us. Ooh.
We will have something to talk about.
Welcome, Doug.
Thanks. Thanks so much. All right, delighted to see all of you again. I feel like it's a homecoming every time I come down here now. I really enjoy this. So this talk this morning will probably be a little different than the ones I usually do, in the sense that what I'm going to do, well, let me tell you how this happened first. Months ago when I was thinking about what to do for the next presentation here, I was listening to one of Ken Wapnick's presentations on a CD, and he was reading a paragraph out of the first section in chapter 26 in the text, which is the sacrifice of oneness, sacrifices in quotes. And he was just going through this particular paragraph, and after one sentence, he just went off on this little 5 or 10 minute talk that just dropped my jaw to the floor. And I thought, you know, that's what I want to talk about when I go to the center the next time for the presentation. And I was telling Nisa about it, and she said, well, maybe you better make that the talk in the afternoon, because that's going to be a thing that's going to bring up a lot of questions and probably take more than an hour to present. And I thought about it, but it's so central to everything that I want to do today that I just segued what we're going to do this afternoon in this talk about us with this talk this morning about the importance of getting past the mythology of the course. And so what I'm going to do this morning is just read to you, I literally lifted this verbatim straight out of this talk that Ken was giving. I'm just going to read through this for you so you can hear what I'm talking about, and then I'm going to go back through it, and unlike what Ken did in the talk, I'm going to just do it line by line so that we can explore what's really meant by these words, because it can be kind of airy-fairy and even New Age sounding if you don't understand the metaphysics of the course or if you don't take the time to think about what you're really hearing. So what I'm going to do this morning is just begin by reading this, and then I'm going to go back and we'll go through it more slowly, and we'll just get as far as we do, and then we'll go into it in more detail this afternoon. So that's the plan. So the title of the talk, of course, is Getting Past the Mythology of A Course in Miracles. And before I start reading that little thing from Ken, I just want to read you a definition of mythology so we're all on the same page there. So mythology is a set of stories, traditions, or beliefs associated with a particular group or the history of an event arising naturally or deliberately fostered. So it can be the stories about something that actually happened historically in the world, or it can be a story that's made up, like Greek mythology, you know, that sort of thing. And so mythology, you know, is used in the broad sense here as I'm talking about this. But as you know from the course of metaphysics, since there is no world, everything here is part of the illusion or part of a myth, part of the mythology that the ego has made up and that we've bought into, which is a way of saying that we, listening to the voice of the ego as a decision maker, have made up and have bought into. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about mythology. Here's the thing from Ken. What Ken was talking about in this section, the sacrifice of oneness, is how we sacrifice our brother's holiness so that we can put our guilt on our brother or our sister so that we get the impression that it's no longer on us. And he was saying that when you do this, you know, when you go, you know, I was so happy until you came into my life and now it's such a drag and it's nothing but problems, problems, problems. Or, you know, I was doing pretty good in the world. My life wasn't perfect, but I was cruising along having a pretty good time until I ran into the Course in Miracles. And now nothing works like it used to, you know. And so what Ken was trying to point out is that when we do this kind of thing, when we reject in this kind of way, we're projecting onto a part of ourselves. We're really attacking ourselves when we attack a brother or a sister. And so the whole point of what he wanted his audience to understand, I think, was that he wanted us to really see that this is more than just an idea. It's more than just a concept. It's an actuality that when you are negative towards anyone, you're being negative towards yourself because we're one. And we'll go into this in more detail about because we're one, because that's one of those things that I was talking about that can sound kind of New Agey if you don't think about the Course in Metaphysics and how that should really be interpreted. So let me read you this. So he's talking about that. And then he was talking about what actually happened for Helen and how where he was going with this is that the trap that we fall into when we make Helen different from us or special compared to us. So he was doing the other side instead of attacking is when we put somebody up on a pedestal. And so what he's doing here is explaining what actually happened when Helen listened to the voice of Jesus. What actually happened was the person we call Helen became all of us in that holy instant when she joined with Jesus, who is the symbol of the perfect love in her mind. This love has no form, but as this love extended through Helen, it was translated into form, which was translated into words, translated into this book that we call A Course in Miracles. The reason this is so important to understand is because the Course is in you. The Course is in you. Otherwise, you will see Helen as special. Bill Thetford, the person who partnered with her to scribe the Course, you will see William Thetford as special. Jesus as special. The Course in Miracles as special. Everyone involved with its inception as special. You will then be making the same mistake the writers of the New Testament made because they couldn't deal with the incredible phenomenon of this presence of light that suddenly appeared in the world. They brought him down to their size. And they wrote about his body, story after story after story, about his birth, about his body's birth, about its journey through the world, about his body's death, about its resurrection, about it sitting at the right hand of the Father in heaven. So the real truth about Jesus and the real message that he was trying to bring, of course, got buried in all of these stories about the body, because the part about the mind just got missed. Not because the Bible writers were trying to do that. It's just that their fear prevented them from seeing what Jesus was really trying to make clear to them. And their fear just blocked them from being able to hear clearly the message that he was giving them. Ken says, don't do this with Helen. Now, the difference between the myths of the Bible as compared to the myths of this course are that we can attest, Ken could attest, and we can all attest from having looked at the books, he can attest to the truth of the story of Helen and Bill and what happened during their lives. One good place, if you're interested in all of this, is the book that Ken wrote called Absence from Felicity. Now, that's the story of Helen, Bill, and the scribing of the course. That's the subtitle of that book. And that's the sort of thing that he's talking about, is all of that stuff. If you really want to learn how this course was written, go inside. Hear the melody of the forgotten song. This tape set that I was listening to was on Becoming the Notes of Sweet Harmony. When you get home and you go blank about what was said today and you want to hear it again, it's a little 2-CD set that Ken did on Becoming the Touches of Sweet Harmony. So if you really want to learn how this course was written, go inside. Hear the melody of the forgotten song. The forgotten song will be one of the sections in the course that we'll go through this afternoon, just the two key paragraphs in there. And then you will realize that this is what Helen did. Go inside and listen to this melody, and as you do that, you'll realize that that's what Helen did. And then you will realize that that is what Helen did. But Helen is all of us because we are all one. Because we all came from the same decision maker. There's only one decision maker. And it decided to divide and subdivide over and over again. And so until we came so multiplicitous that it's practically impossible for us to remember that we were one. And we're all run because we're not separated. That is how you become one with this course, is by going inside and listening to the melody that this course is encouraging you to do. So then Ken says, you know who saved you? You. You saved you. Your decision-making mind saved you. There is nothing else. It looked, the decision-making mind, it looked at the ego and said, uh-uh, no thanks, never again. It looked at Jesus and said, this is the one that I love because he represents the Son of God. He looked at Jesus and said, this is the one that I love because he represents the Son of God that represents that love. He represents that love whom I heard that beautiful song with long, long ago in an ancient time that seemed so distant. But it is right now because there is no time. Just like there is no world. If you insist that the shabby image of yourself that you see in the mirror each morning is who you are, you can never do what was just described. This is a course that undoes specialness. It doesn't inculcate it. It doesn't create a cult around it. Take the story of Helen and Bill and the scribing of the course as a metaphor for what it is. It is a wonderful example of forgiveness. It is a wonderful example of what happens when you go to your right mind. The Course is in you. It is in everyone. The Course is one form, one song in form of the forgotten song. It is nonspecific. It is abstract. It has no notes. It has no words. Otherwise, if you don't do this, you are going to get bogged down in specialness again, bogged down in the world of time and space, bogged down in individuality and separate bodies. And with that, he went back, right back, to reading what he was talking about in this section, the sacrifice of oneness. And again, we'll look at that section also this afternoon. We simply just won't have time to do that this morning. So what I want to do is go back through this kind of line by line and explain what all of that, how that really segues with the metaphysics of the Course in Miracles. So what actually happened was that the person we call Helen became all of us in that holy instant. Now, this is what I mean by one of those things that can sound kind of, what does that mean? What does that mean? We give a lot of lip service, you know, to we're all one, we're all joined, we all come from the same source. But a lot of us probably don't stop and think about what does that really mean and how is that really possible? So the first thing I want to talk about is the holy instant. The holy instant is that instant outside of time when we choose a miracle instead of a grievance, when we choose forgiveness instead of a grievance, when we listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit or Jesus instead of the voice of the ego. And that instant is outside of time because that's where the mind that the Course in Miracles is talking about is. It's not in time. It's outside of time, dreaming time and dreaming space. And so you often hear me speak when I come here about how the way to think about your life in the world when this kind of metaphysical principle puzzles you is just think about your nighttime dreams. They seem perfectly real while you're sleeping. So this mind that's outside of time and space seemed to put itself to sleep. It's a mind that's one with God and cannot be anything else because that's not God's will for it. And nothing that is not God's will can happen. This is a non-dualistic course. There is no opposite to love. Anything outside of heaven is an illusion. And so life outside of heaven is impossible in terms of the basic principles of this course. So in order for the ego to experience itself as an individual body in a world of separation, the only way that it could experience that was to have the mind seem to go to sleep and dream that it was possible. Because in reality, it's not possible. So the holy instant, again, is that instant outside of time when the mind changes from the wrong mind to the right mind, from the wrong teacher to the teacher that corrects that wrong-minded thought of separation. So the way that Helen became all of us was that in that mind outside of time and space, there's only one. There's only one mind. And so it's not some hocus-pocus thing. It's the metaphysics of what is actually going on. Any of us, when we go into our right mind, would exclude no one because we would realize that everyone is us. even though the forms that our eyes seem to report to us are multiplicitous in terms of the differences between each one of us, even twins, we're still all one in terms of the content of the mind. And the content of the mind is the only thing that this course is concerned with. It doesn't give a flying doodah about form, except as an outer reflection that tells us what's going on in the mind. I'm sorry. So in that holy instant, of course, Helen was joined with all of us, was joined with Jesus, and was joined with the love of God. And, of course, Jesus is the symbol of that perfect love in her mind. And so we use Jesus and whatever image that we hold of Jesus as just a stepping stone to get us past images into the formless. And that's what Helen was doing. She turned to Jesus, and that was a symbol that appealed to her. If the symbol of Jesus doesn't appeal to you, if you have a whole lot of trouble with that, I would certainly encourage you to work on forgiveness around that. But you can pick any symbol that you want. It doesn't make any difference. Jesus won't be in a huff about it, I promise. So this love has no form. You know, one of the attributes that we always describe when we describe heaven or God is that it's formless. It's formless. It has no form. It's abstract. Now, that's problematic for us because, of course, we can't then picture it in our mind. And so even though we understand the definition of abstract and we know what the word formless means, there's no way we can pull a picture of it up in our mind because it's formless. So that's problematic for us. But it's not necessary for us to be able to do that. In fact, it's impossible for us to be able to do that. And so that's the importance of symbols. That's why we use a symbol like Jesus, who each of us has a particular picture in our mind of what he looked like or looks like. And so we just use that symbol again as a stepping stone to segue into the formlessness of this love that we're talking about. And more importantly, the experience of this love, the peacefulness of this love, the quietness of this love, the kindness of this love, the enormous appeal of this love, the irresistible appeal of this love. So as this love extended through Helen, as she allowed it to do in her mind, it was translated into form. It was translated into words, a book that we can seem to hold in our hands here in the world of form. Now, just like Mozart was inspired. You know, the music just came through him. It was abstract, but because of his tremendous mastery of classical music, he was able to translate that formless inner experience into music. And we ended up with this beautiful celestial music that Mozart gifted the world with. And again, the reason this is so important to understand is because this course is in you. It's in your mind. Helen didn't go someplace that we can't go. Helen didn't have some special skill or some special attribute that we don't have. She simply had the willingness to go there and the desire to go there in spite of the raucous shriekings of her ego. And as any of you who know the story of Helen know, she had a very raucous ego. I mean, at the level of form, you know, the particular form of her ego was something. Of course, the particular form of any of our egos is something if you look at it carefully. Helen just got examined a little more closely than we're prone to examine ourselves. So the important thing, again, to get here is that it's in you. This course is not external to you. It's in you. It's in your right mind. That's what lives there. It just took this particular form. And that's very handy for us because we keep forgetting that we've got a right mind. And so we can at least go pick up the book and read the words and get reminded once again that the course is in us. This course is not telling us anything, giving us any information that we didn't already have. It's just reminding us it's in us. This course is in our minds. So if you can keep that in mind, as you go through your daily doings, it'll stop you from putting yourself above and below others, or putting others above and below you, which is not a sin. It's just a simple little mistake. But once you're doing that, even to the slightest degree, it makes it impossible for you to actually join in love with this other person because you see them as different. And of course, what will happen with that is that you'll then skew all of that in terms of filtering it through the eyes of your needs as you look at this other person. Do they meet my needs the way I've set them up, or don't they? You know, and I'll decide they're great because they do, they're not so great because they don't. And so it's critically important that we get that the love is in us and the love is in everyone. And so what we want to do is make it our business to look for that love in others, because that spark, that what is referred to in the forgotten song is that wisp of melody, from this forgotten song, which is the song the Father sings to the Son in praise and the Son sings to the Father in praise. And that's not actually, that's all metaphor, of course. In heaven, there is no Father and Son that is separate. It's a state of complete unity, a oneness joined as one. And so this song is just a way of expressing poetically and very beautifully this connection, this interconnectedness in heaven that is continuous and eternal. And of course, as I pointed out before, the failure to do this, the failure to recognize that this wisp of melody is in all of us, this little memory of the forgotten song is in all of us, is to remember it's in my mind and that I can look at you from that place in my mind. And if I'll do that, I'll instantly and spontaneously, with no thought on my part, connect with that part in you, even though it might be complete in a completely trivial way. And so again, the formlessness of that love will get translated into a form. I will take a sincere interest in whatever you're interested in because you're my brother, and it's my pleasure to do that. Not because I'm some loving, wonderful being. It's because it's the only thing that will make me feel truly free and truly happy. I'll be doing it for myself, if you will, and it'll just be the gift to both of us. But it will allow me to connect with anyone, anywhere, around any set of circumstances. Whereas the failure to do this will lead to falling right back into the trap of specialness again. This person's better than I am, this person's worse than I am, in some maybe even imperceptible gradient that I'm not even aware that I'm doing. So I suspect most of you are fairly familiar with the temptation to make this course special, the temptation to make Jesus special. For me, it's a horrible temptation to make Ken special. So I probably don't need to spend time going into an explanation of that unless someone just wants me to. I'll go on.
Sure.
Go into it? Who said it? You want me to go into it? No. Oh, it's you. Deep thought. Actually, that was rude. Deepa simply wants me to go deeper. Which would always be good advice for me. And so again, keeping this principle in mind that I just talked about, that this wisp of melody, this memory of this song, and incidentally, the reason it's only a little wisp of melody and not the whole song is because if we had the whole song available to us right there in our mind, and we could look at this beautiful, resplendent song that's of eternal bliss and peace and harmony, and compare that to what we're experiencing here in the world, we would drop the world like a hot potato. But we're afraid of that because we've listened to the ego story, which says, listen, all of that stuff about a beautiful song sounds sweet and all of that, but believe me, the truth is God's really angry with you, and if he can get his hands on you again, he's going to punish you forever. And we bought that story, and we've become afraid of even attempting to hear that melody, that sweet wisp of melody, because we're afraid that we'll lose all of this stuff that we've worked so hard to build up for ourselves during our lifetime in this world. All of the specialness that I've tried to accumulate for myself and have gone to such great lengths and great expense and great time and trouble to acquire for myself. And so the ego says, all that's going to happen is that you're going to lose all of this stuff that you've managed to put together for yourself at great price and at great struggle, and you're just going to be punished forever. That's all you're going to get. So again, the failure to remember that this little spark of light is in each of us, and that that's where this course really is the only way to avoid falling into the trap of specialists, which again is the same trap that the writers of the Bible fell into. This person seemed to suddenly appear in their world and started telling them about something that was completely disconnected to their world. And of course, all of their egos panicked. They went through this thing that I just described. Oh my God, what's going to happen to my business? What's going to happen to my special relationships? What's going to happen to the money that I've got and the money that I want to make and the things that I want to do and the places that I want to go and all the scores that I want to make, you know, all the winning that I want to do? What's going to happen to all of that? And of course, just psychologically, they tended to place Jesus in somewhat the same boat as themselves, even though the words that he was saying was describing something different than what they were experiencing in the world, because they simply saw him as another man, as a body in a world of bodies. And they couldn't get past this. So I'm not implying or insinuating here in any way that the writers of the Bible were evil people who were trying to distort the truth and keep it from us. They were falling into the same trap that so many of us who've tried to work with this course have fallen into ourselves. In fact, I suspect all of us have fallen into it. I mean, I know I've fallen into it. I fall into it every day. It's difficult at first as you begin to make this transition. It's a little rocky, you know. It's not what we're comfortable with. It's not the way that we're used to thinking about things. It's not the way that we're used to looking at things. And so I'm not faulting them, but I am stating in no uncertain terms that it was their fear that interfered with their ability to see. Sorry about that pun. That was a total accident, the fear that interfered. All right, who said that? So the real truth got buried out of fear. And don't do that with Helen. Don't make that mistake with Helen. Don't put her on a pedestal. She was no different than you and I. She was different at the level of form, but she was no different than you and I in terms of being a product of the decision maker and came from the same origins as we ourselves seem to come. And again, the difference between the myths of the Bible and the myths of the Course in Miracles is that we can have it on good authority that the myths of the Course in Miracles, the story of Helen Bill and the scribing of the Course, is accurate. It's what actually happened. Not so much with the Bible. We have no way of being sure exactly what all that is about. And so much of it was written down so long after the life of Jesus, after so many translations and so many, not translations, but so many verbal renditions of it, and then the writing down of it and the rewriting of it, that it quite likely may have become distorted. So that's the difference in the mythologies in terms of their accuracy. But a myth is a myth is a myth. So if you really want to learn how this course was written, go inside. Go into your mind. As those of you who've worked with the workbook know, a lot of that workbook is about giving your mind something to play with so it can quiet down, giving it a nice, peaceful idea that it can resonate around so that it can learn how to quiet and become still and become more peaceful and less raucous and less interruptive. And so going inside and becoming still is not some magical thing, and it's not something that anyone is incapable of doing. You can do it while you're busy with your body. If you're one of these people that just can't hold still, you can do it while you're walking. You can do it while you're rock climbing. In fact, if you're rock climbing, you probably have become focused inside and one-pointed, as the Buddhists like to talk about in terms of focusing the mind. And so it's not something, I'm not talking about form here. You do this however it suits you. I'm sure at this point in all of our lives, we've all figured out ways to do this for ourselves, or have at least explored avenues about that. Hear the melody. Now, again, this melody is this little wisp of melody, this song of love that resonates in the right mind and is the content of the right mind. You want to listen for that. You want to actively search for that. And then when you begin to get in touch with that, and all of you are already in touch with that, all of you have felt this, all of you have experienced this, it comes and goes quite quickly, even without notice sometimes. But we've all been there. It's impossible that we haven't referenced it in any times of deep appreciation for something, deep beyond just the ego getting what it wants. We've experienced this. And so this is not some airy-fairy, impossible-to-reach state. It's, as Jesus points out to us, it's much easier than staying in this upheaved condition that we usually find ourselves in the chaos of the wrong mind, filled with attack thoughts, judgments, vindictiveness, the wish to project. And then you will realize that that is what Helen did. You know, people used to come to Helen all the time, and you know, at first the stuff was about tell me what to do and tell me what to say and tell me this and tell me that, and later on it became more questions of would Helen please ask Jesus what he thinks about blah blah blah, and Helen would say, you know, you have the same mind that I have, and you can do this just as well as I can. Don't think that I have something that you don't have. Don't make me special. And she was really firm about this, even contrite almost sometimes with people. If people were too insistent about that, she would put them in their place about it. Because it's silly business to think that Helen could do it for us. It's just as it's silly business to think that Jesus can save you. Only you can save you. I can't do it. Nobody can do it. I'm still trying to save myself. Be clear that when you're working with this course is about you working with your mind, of being willing to go in there and be still and come to peace, and then take that peace with you out into your relationships in the world and extend that to everyone that you meet, everyone without exception. Because if you're tempted to withhold it from anyone, once again, the whole point of this that Ken was trying to make is that you will then withhold it from yourself. And that's what he didn't want us to do. It's not just that he didn't want us being mean to each other. He didn't want us being mean to ourselves, because he recognized that each other and us is the same. I and you are the same, because we're one, because we're one mind. We're one decision maker, making a faulty decision and having the opportunity now to realize that I can go inside and make a better decision, find a better way to look on my brothers and sisters, a more peaceful way, a kinder way, a more embracing way, an inclusive way. And you can't do this with everyone at the level of form, but you can certainly do it with everyone at the level of the content of the mind. You can look on an entire football stadium full of people and love them all. You can't have them all over for dinner. You can't go out with them all. You can't buy them all birthday presents. But you can extend this presence of love through you to them as you look on them and feel it. You can feel the kindly embrace that includes everyone without exception. It has to be without exception, or it's not inclusive. Withhold one jot, one person, one circumstance from this inclusion, and you've excluded yourself and everyone else in the process. So that's what Helen did, and that's what we can all do, because we're one and because we're not separated. That is how you become one with this course. You don't become one with this course by mastering it intellectually. That in itself takes a little bit, but that's not what this course is about. That's totally the booby prize. It's actually not a booby prize even. It's handy to have all of that straight, because it helps you work your way out of the conundrums that we work ourselves into. But that in and of itself is pointless. It's only applying that understanding and applying that familiarity with the course to your actual relationships with everyone and everything in the world that this course becomes exceedingly valuable to you. Because it's only then that you will show yourself that this course is in you. It's only when you make the effort to go through the steps of forgiveness, the process of forgiveness, with each person that you encounter that seems to cause you difficulty, because you've judged them. And so what you do is you work your way from the person back to the judgment in your mind, and there you forgive it. You realize, I'm not upset by the external thing. I'm upset because I'm looking at this external thing through the eyes of my ego. I'm using my ego as my guide instead of the Holy Spirit or love or kindness or gentleness or any word you want to use like that as my guide. So that's how the process works. And so It's you that saves you. It's not this course that saves you. It's not Jesus that saves you. It's not the Holy Spirit that saves you. It's you being willing to find the love within yourself and to begin to identify with that more and more instead of the raucous shrieks of your ego that goes, I need, I need, I need. You know, I'll give up this world next year after the Broncos have had another chance to win the Super Bowl, and then I'll work on this course. I'll work on this course as soon as this person, as soon as I can get away from this person. There's this constant state of irritation to myself. And what you do when you do that is you throw the gift that this person is pleading with you to take that is this constant irritation. This constant irritation is coming from their fear, and their fear is arousing your fear. It's reminding of you of your fear, and that's why you find them so irritating. They're showing you something that you're trying to hide from yourself, and you're PO'd about that because you don't want to be reminded. Again, we've gone to a great deal of trouble to bury this right mind so that we can live in the world and romp around to the dictates of our wrong mind. And so we throw away a gift every time something disturbs us and we don't work with it. Now, this by no means means that things are not going to disturb you or that getting this information and really beginning to understand it will make your life a breeze. It almost certainly won't. It'll make your life more disjunctive in a lot of ways because you used to have these strategies where you just went out and slammed the door and went to a movie and tried to deny all of this turmoil that was in your mind. Now you're realizing the only way out of this turmoil is to work my way back through it to the point where I can see that I'm the turmoil's author. I'm the one that's sponsoring this. The turmoil is coming from me. It's not coming from some experience I am having in the external world, whether that experience is psychological and emotional or whether it's physical. If it's physical pain that you're dealing with, and I know most of us, as I look around the room, based on my own experience, are probably experiencing some level of physical pain most of the time, just in the form of a little ache in the back and a little stiff neck, and when I stand up, I have to move around for a minute before I can walk correctly, and that sort of thing. You know? But that's the decision of the mind just as much as deciding to be angry or deciding to be irritated or deciding to have any other experience that I decide to give myself. And another critical point here is the role of purpose in all of this. Whenever I'm doing that, whenever I'm choosing to experience physical pain, psychological pain, emotional pain, loneliness, sorrow, loss, da-da-da-da-da-da, there's a purpose behind that. And it's the purpose of keeping this wisp of melody away from my mind. If I'm preoccupied and totally upset about what's going on with the Denver Broncos, I'm certainly not going to be looking for peace in my mind. And so my ego is a big Broncos fan. You know, it's just one of the smarter things that it's ever done. But shows some hints of wisdom anyway. But I don't mean to cloud the importance of the role of purpose in this. Whenever you're upset to any extent about anything, no matter what it is, it's purposive. And its purpose is to protect you from the love that you're so fearful of. Because again, you're afraid of losing the world if you turn to this love. You're afraid that you would give up the world if you heard only this love, which you would. It, again, seems like a loss from this side, but when you get on the other side, you realize, oh my God, am I glad to be done with that. I mean, all of us have had worldly experiences of this as we were growing up. We became so attached to some toy that we had when we were a child. You know, it was the be-all, end-all for us, you know, and if we couldn't find it, we were in a panic. But how important really was that toy, and how important is that toy now? It's not important at all. I can't even remember what it was, you know. So we outgrow this world, and you do that at your own pace. You know, the Course says, fear not that you will be snatched up and abruptly hurled into reality. You'll go at your own pace because you brought you here, and you're going to be the one that decides the pace as you move away. As you gradually withdraw your investment in this world at whatever pace is comfortable for you and doesn't arouse the fear to panic. And so that's the work of this course, is finding your pace, finding your velocity as you leave this world. Again, in the metaphysics of the course, there's nothing else but the decision-making mind and its dreams. And so when I titled this course, Getting Past the Mythology of This Course, I didn't mean to imply in any way that the mythology of this course is not useful for us as an example, and is not instructive for us in terms of reading the stories of Helen and Bill and the trials and tribulations that they went through with each other and many, many others in their lives, as instructive and for us as we begin to do it with the special relationships in our lives. And so each of us will do this with the particular special relationships that we have in our lives, with those others with whom we interact, with whom we think about, who stay on our minds. And they can be people who are actually in our lives now, or people that once were in our lives and are no longer in our lives because they've moved away or have died, or they're for some reason no longer in contact with us. Or it can be simply people that we see in the news or have heard about or read about and have had no actual contact with in our lives at all. Symbols like Adolf Hitler. Just any figure that you would think of in the historical world that you've made important and that you have things going on about. So it's not that the stories are useless to us or unimportant to us or meaningless to us in any kind of way. Again, they're quite instructive and they're quite useful for us, and they give us a real heads up that this isn't going to be a cakewalk. I mean, Helen and Bill had a terrible time with each other. Again, any of you who've read Absence from Felicity know this. And, of course, you know it also from having tried it in your own lives. It's not just them. It's all of us. We all must struggle with this temptation to judge. And so all of us will have to do that. So I'm just going to draw this little talk to a conclusion now because it's about 12 minutes before the hour, and I want to give you a chance to ask any questions that this may have brought up for you. And again, in this afternoon's presentation, we'll reiterate all of this stuff and go into it in even more detail. So, questions, comments?
It was a number of years ago that I actually ran into some people who, they didn't want to do the course almost for the opposite reason of what you're saying. It, I guess, makes Helen special in an opposite way. They didn't think the course was legit because she wasn't some holy person who had been on the mountain and received this information. I'm paraphrasing, you know, what they said, but I just wondered if you care to speak to that.
Yeah, well, Helen would have been in favor of that also. She wants to ask Jesus, why didn't you ask some nun to do this or somebody like that instead of me? And, of course, Jesus' answer, which Helen had no retort for, was because you'll do it. Jesus is just being a pragmatist. That was my initial reaction to Helen. It was like, it wasn't that I wasn't going to do the course because of her, but I thought, this is the oddest thing that this woman, who's obviously, you know, totally under the sway of her ego a great deal of the time, and I really didn't know the details of Helen's life at all when I first started doing this. I just knew a few things about her. Why this woman in this role, you know? And I found that a little disjunctive. But I soon began to realize, oh, she's the perfect person for us because she had an ego in spades and she had a right mind in spades. She could do both better than almost all of us. And so she pegged the meter on both sides. So she covered the whole spectrum of everything that anybody might go through in terms of the content, if not the form. So she's perfect in that role once you understand that. But I can understand that person's reaction. You know, I had some of that myself.
How do you do it? You're married, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, do you struggle with specialness with your wife and make her your favorite Valentine? And, you know, I mean, do you...
Oh, yes.
How does that work in here? I mean,
yes.
I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I understand that question. I get it.
Specialness in your marriage, or special... I mean, I made Johnny Depp special. I mean...
Sure. You know, Yes, I play it to the hilt. because I enjoy it. So both Nisa and I know that's what's going on, but we both do it because we both like it. You know, and so we know that underneath it, we're just teasing. You know, we're not teasing, we're just having fun with it. But yes, I gave her a Valentine. She's got it with her right now. And so.
Is this your wife over here?
Yes, this is my wife, Lisa, right here for you. You don't know that. Yeah, yeah.
Not to me.
Please do.
That's
fine.
It's Linda.
So the idea in all of this, in any of your work with the Course, in your special relationships that are the ones that are really close to you, and in your special relationships with your car and your yard and your house and your hair and anything, the idea is not to get beyond it and not have it anymore. It's to not take it seriously. It's to be lighthearted about it, to make it fun for yourself if you can. I mean, that's my choice. That's just because that stylistically appeals to me more. You don't have to do that. It's not a mandated thing. But it is a mandated thing that if you're going to get over it, you've got to lighten up about it. So the whole idea is to look at the ego and without being past it or being over it, learn to smile at it. Oh, there it goes again, you know. Here I am again, standing in front of the mirror, worrying about my hair before I go to the Miracle Center, you know? Yeah. My hair is hardly worth worrying about, but there I am.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Over here, Doug.
Doug, I'm still... Helen wasn't really at peace when she left us.
I'll just tell this for those who don't know. At the end of Helen's life, her mental condition had deteriorated enormously, and even before that, she had gotten crankier and crankier in terms of her ego self. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be what outpictured for her at the end in her life in the world. But Ken Watney says that, in fact, he writes about this in Absence for Felicity, that Jesus had always told Helen while he was working with her, dictating this course, that at the end of her life, he would come for her. Again, very sweet. And when Ken saw Helen's body after she had died, he said the look on her face was the most peaceful he'd ever seen. So one of the things that is reassuring to me about this course is that in spite of the machinations of my ego and the internal conflict that causes me, that even if I'm doing that, if I'm choosing that as I go through my seemingly dying process, the dying of my body in the world, then I'm still perfectly safe. You know, I often tell people a story about my mother that says, and the story is that when I was little and I would get afraid, my mother would say, "It will be all right, it'll be all right." And the sincerity of her statement and the surety of it told me it was all right, even though I knew that at the level of form, she didn't have some magical power to make the bee sting go away or my upset about something that happened at school go away. But I knew it would be all right. And I think that's what I take from the story about Helen, is that whatever our worldly experience is, beyond that, it'll be all right. This world is just where we take the steps, and sometimes they're painful.
Tell us about when Helen said, "I know this is true, I just don't want to believe it."
Well, of course, what she's putting her finger right on there for us all is that her right mind longed for what this course reminded her of. It reminded her was her. And her right mind, because she could go there and be in her right mind, she was very well acquainted with that part of herself. She knew this was true. But she didn't want to believe it from the ego side because it meant that she had to relinquish all of that stuff that's all about the ego, which is all of the stuff that most of our lives, it's almost the entire form of our lives. It's almost, the content of the wrong mind is almost what's outpictured everywhere always. And so she was going to have to give up all of this prestige as a, you know, her attachment to all, she didn't have to give up the prestige, she had to give up her attachment to the prestige. And she didn't have to give up her body, but she had to give up her attachment to the body. And she didn't have to give up her intellect, but she had to give up her attachment to the intellect. And so that's why she didn't want to believe it, because that's what she had identified herself as. You know, so again, she was speaking for us all. It was this split-minded condition that we're all in here in the world, where we want to go home, but we want to bring all of our specialist toys with us. And of course, you can't do that. You know, you can't do that. It's one or the other. And it feels like a great sacrifice to give that up, because we've trained ourselves from time immemorial that that's what we want. And now this course comes along and says, you don't want this world. You really don't want this world. Look at it. Do you really think that you want to be born in pain and through pain and suffer all the days of your life and then wither and gasp and be laid in the ground? Is that really what you want? That was all quotes from the course, for those of you who recognize that. And so it's, again, the condition that we're all in is this split-mindedness. Well, thank you very much. Thank you all.
Thank you.